Welcome, dear listener, to Weekend at Crombie's Season 6, Episode 1. Tonight, we shall be taking La Grande Vadrouille. Bonjour et bienvenue, madame et monsieur, pour un week-end chez Crombie. Je m'appelle Hugh. You two at the back, all you do is chit-chat.
And my name is Dr. James Evans, Esquire. That's a harp.
Very good. For you may tell by the effort that some of us were making with the language, yes. Is we are doing a long-awaited. We've never had a film with such anticipation built up because we announced it in 2022 and then took a year off to do westerns. But yeah, we're back
randomly just because we felt like it at that particular point in time. But yes, here we are.
Yeah, which is the ethos of Weekend at Crombie's. Anyway, we're here and back to the traditional stance of Weekend at Crombie's random films. Although again, we'll come to the analysis. I probably broken many of the rules in picking films, but never mind.
It doesn't matter, does it?
I know. We've waited long enough. It's too late now. So let's jump right into La Grande Vadrouille, which, as you can probably tell, is a French language film.
Although it's hard to say, it is better than its English title, Don't Look Now, We're Being Shot At.
Yes.
Which is just the worst name for a film.
And they say it is not the translation of La Grande Vadrouille.
No, it isn't, is it?
It is The Big Stroll.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is so much quirkier. I mean, Don't Look Now Being Shot At really has that kind of carry-on line for
it.
This is the 1960s copy.
It's not that film, is it?
It's not that film. Although maybe they just thought it was because that was what was being put out in the British in the 60s in terms of comedy.
Yeah,
but maybe. We'll come to that too. However, we'll do a quick recap faster than a Messerschmitt flying through the skies.
Well, we've got practice of this now, haven't we?
Indeed, we do. So, yeah. Well, we begin in the kind of like rotoscoped footage. You know, a bomber is it's World War II. A British bomber is flying over Germany. Anti-aircraft guns are flying over. It's shooting the plane down. They're dropping their bombs. They're flying home. They're taking flak. And you think, oh, this is a bit getting serious. And then the pilot removes his gas mask.
Oh, it's Terry Thomas.
Terry Thomas with the biggest moustaches you'll ever see. They literally pop out of his gas mask.
Although I would say, although it is definitively Terry Thomas, he looks the airman, doesn't he?
Oh, those moustaches, absolutely.
Yeah, but I mean, I'd be indifference to him.
Indeed, this is Sir Reginald, otherwise just generally known as the big moustache, the grand moustache.
Yeah.
So their bomber gets shot down, and because their map up was the first thing to get shot, they think they're over Calais, but in fact they see the Eiffel Tower and realise they're actually over Paris, as Terry Thomas just says, Macintosh.
So,
he says this a lot. Yeah. So they all bail out. Some of them, we assume, are caught by the Germans, but three of them manage to evade capture. And before they jump out, they say, we'll rendezvous at the Turkish baths, because Reginald knows Paris. He knows he's been there before. So he goes, go to the Turkish baths. T for two, which is the name of their mission, is the code word. So that's where we'll know who we are.
They've got to whistle it, haven't they? They've got to whistle T for two.
Yeah. T for two, for two, for two. Anyway, so they all bail out. And so Reginald lands in the zoo, in kind of the seal enclosure, where he's helped out by the friendly zookeeper, who gives him a change of clothes and says, Monsieur, your moustaches are too conspicuous.
And the thing is, listeners will think that he's being racist here, but that is what the zookeeper sounds like when he's trying to speak English.
It is actually a wonderfully bilingual, not trilingual, really.
There's a lot of German in it as well, isn't there?
There's German, but do you know what? I can almost tell the German is, when the Germans speak French, they're speaking it with a German accent.
Yeah, they are.
And they also speak German. The French speak both German and English, and obviously French.
Yeah,
some of the Englishmen speak French.
Terry Thomas speaks French and English.
Yeah, yeah. So, so it's flying all over the place. So, which is actually quite good because
it is. Yeah, but it feels natural, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot of confusion because not everyone speaks everyone's language too, which just adds to the hilarity.
Yeah.
We should say again, this is a comedy, and boy, is it a comedy. So Terry Thomas lands in the sea enclosure and is rescued, given a change of clothes, and directed to the Turkish baths.
I like the fact that you had to confirm that it was a comedy. It's got Terry Thomas in it. I mean, and Louis Defunes and Bourville, who are both, French comedians. But anyway.
Yeah. Cunningham, who's another airman, basically lands on a kind of a painter's cradle, where one of our main characters, Bouvy, Augustine Bouvier is painting with basically, I think, it's a comedically small brush the side of the house.
Touches of Benny Hill about it, I thought.
Yeah, and he's actually
it's huge, isn't it? It's like a trellis he's painting.
Yeah, and he's got a tiny little brush. He's basically doing one strand at a time. He's quite happy, but Bouvier is a simple man, I suppose, is the best way to say it. He's got simple tastes, and he basically doesn't want to get landed on by an airman, especially because the wall he's painting is directly above like SS parade ground. So the first thing that happens is he drops his big bucket of white paint all over the Gestapo colonel, who gets covered in it. So now Bouvier is kind of on the hoof because
he's inculcated in it, isn't he? Even though he's really got nothing to do with what's going on.
He's now being shot at as well. So him and Cunningham kind of run over the rooftops to escape. They get into an apartment building where the nearest door they can find is by his young lady Juliette, and again thinking quite on his feet as the Germans are knocking on the door, Bouvier kind of immediately pretends to be a put upon husband rowing with his wife. Juliette kind of jumps into the role as well, and they kind of do all this business to again disguise the fact that Cunningham is hiding there. So they then decide, okay, well, Cunningham, who doesn't speak French, can't go to the Turkish baths. Bouvier will go instead and make contact, and the third airman, who's Macintosh, drops on the opera, where we meet our final character, who's
Stanislas Lefort.
Stanislas Lefort, played by Louis de Funès, who is a very, very short, very energetic opera conductor.
I think, he's got a bit of Napoleon syndrome, perhaps.
Absolutely. He's very choleric. And again, he's just brimming with energy, like yelling at all his orchestra to start with. Again, he's quite admired by the local German major, Auer Achbach, who's kind of got time for him because he's a proper cultural person. Like they're doing a big Wagner opera for this SS.
Right, yeah, it's like his name, obviously.
Yeah. In the meanwhile, the resistance are filling the floral arrangement full of plastic. Everything's going on here. Yeah.
The actors in the opera are part of the resistance, aren't they?
Dressed as
Faust.
Yeah. One guy is just in this ridiculous kind of devil leotard as he's planning the resistance bombing too. So Stanislaus is kind of, as he's relaxing in his changing room, he meets Macintosh, who basically says, "You've got to hide me, I'm an airman." And basically he kind of reasons it out saying, "If I turn you in, I'll get the blame. If I send you off, they'll lead you back to me, I'll get the blame. I suppose I better help you then." Yeah. We say no one is actually leaping to the war effort. They're kind of helping these guys out just because they're in a jam rather than any kind of we must fight for the good cause. Yeah. Like, oh God, I'll sort it.
Yeah, so these characters are not the resistance, are they? No, they're not Vichy France either, but they are they are there, and they have a moral duty, but at the same time it's just a bit annoying, isn't it?
Yeah, they're just trying to get by and not get shot, really. And so they're both Stanislaus and Bouvier go to the Turkish baths. Unfortunately, Reginald has shaved off his enormous moustache. So there's some hilarious scenes where both characters are going around looking at other men. Again, they're all naked.
There has to be one man who's got an enormous moustache.
It's not Reginald, And because they're all kind of just wearing towels in this really steam atmosphere. And they're just wearing around, eyeing everyone up and just going like, tea for two, and humming at them and winking and all this kind of stuff. And it's all very awkward. And at the point, I think Stanislaus and Bouvier make contact and think each other is English. So they're speaking to each other in broken English before they work out they can actually have a proper conversation in French. And then they meet up with Reginald. So they've all now they've all now connected up, and they decide they're going to have got to go to the opera to get Cunningham. Cunningham was probably the dumbest of all the airmen, because he's like hiding initially. Again, he's disguised as like someone who's taking a harp lesson from Stanislaus. Yeah. So the German major comes in, and Stanislaus, he bluffs it quite well, saying, "Oh, you think I've got an airman here? Is he in the cupboard? Is he in here? No, I don't have an airman in here." And as soon as the door's closed, Cunningham just goes, "Phew, that was close." He's like, Shut up.
Wait till he's gone.
So he puts him in a cupboard, but then Cunningham manages to knock over a bucket and get the stuff back in. So he's on the run, but basically the jig is up with Stanislaus. He's now, the German major knows he's in. And the German major hides in Cunningham's cupboard to surprise him. So Stanislaus kind of placed under house arrest, but Reginald and Bouvier are going into the opera. I think they steal German uniforms in the Turkish baths to kind of...
That's right, yeah.
which is tricky because neither of them speak German.
Also, they're both quite distinctively shaped as well, aren't they? So that's amazing. I mean, what I quite like about this as well is that there's quite a lot of change of uniforms and clothes. Yeah, and they never fit properly. No. They're either too baggy or too tight.
There's much running around. In fact, when they take their place in the royal box, they accidentally defuse the floral arrangement. Yeah. So instead of blowing up, it just once again covers the episode in flour. So he's once again
really annoyed.
Yeah, but again, they managed to now they basically rearrest Stanislaus. So now they take him into their custody and find Cunningham, who's now dressed as a chorus girl, and all four of them leg it into the sewers, where they go along to try and escape. And they've made their escape now, and they work out what they can do next. So again, there's a great scene. Terry Thomas pokes his head out of a manhole and sees basically women's ankles, and there's the most Terry Thomas expression on his face. It's like he gives that gap-toothed grin of I say. So they realise they're kind of in a red light here, I think, is the implication.
Basically, yeah.
And he reckons, Cunningham's a big strapping fellow. They tart him up because he's still dressed as a woman for the chorus girl. And they send him up there, but with the manhole cover removed. So whenever someone comes up to proposition him, he just goes down the hole. Yeah. So there's this great scene where they just go fishing for random guys come down the manhole. They take all their clothes off them and tie them up. And then they've got four new disguises. Yeah. So they're great. Yeah. So that's their scheme. However, the plan was to get on a train and head for the Free French.
Yeah, they don't get there in time, do they?
So what's happened is that Cunningham and Juliet have done it.
Yes.
They've jumped on the train. They can't wait. The train has taken off. So these four have run up. They've missed their train. So they just steal a mail truck and drive off into the countryside. So now we've left the scenes of Paris. We're still barely halfway through the movie. Yeah.
And this is the great stroll now, isn't it? You see some lovely scenery. Oh, it makes you want to go to France.
Yeah, so there's so actually we'll cut to the train quickly. Cunningham again is we said that Macintosh is Cunningham's not much better because he speaks no French and is not good at bluffing that he doesn't speak French. So he's having dinner with the buffet guy rather than like lying low and not drawing his attention. He's just tucking into his dinner.
He's sitting opposite an SS commander, isn't he?
Yeah, a chatty German officer who's really keen to practice his French on him.
Yeah, exactly.
Firstly, he says, "Can you pass the salt?" And Cunningham's like, "Ugh." So Juliet is like a nearby table and she frantically pours salt all over her dinner. It's like salt, 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 and then it's the pepper. It's pepper, 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 and then he starts quoting poetry at the guy. He gets jostled, and then immediately goes English. Oh, I'm terribly sorry. it's the great escape thing all over again. So he gets taken into custody. Or there's in a comedic thing, there's a really nice moment when because Juliet is still on the train, and she can't obviously identify herself to Cunningham, but she does a little kind of V for victory on the window screen, and Cunningham just gives her a V sign, so it's like, you know, we'll be back for you. So Juliet hooks up with the local resistance who's running a hotel, but meanwhile the grand stroll is underway. Once the cars run out of petrol and they have to walk, how they don't get caught.
The British basically just like they march off, don't they?
They're in lockstep, whistling "Rule Britannia." They march off. Meanwhile, again, because they're in stolen clothes, of course, nothing really fits. Stanislaus is in really fancy opera shoes, too tight and not made for walking. Yeah. So he managed to persuade Bouvet to switch shoes with him. It's a very outspoken class difference. Again, Stanislaus is a high class, articulate, cultured. Bouvet's a
punter, isn't he?
He's a blue collar worker. And Stanislaus is very aware of this. It's like, give me your shoes. I need your shoes. So they kind of.
But this is where they pair off a little bit, don't they? This is where you get the comedic interludes between Bouvet and Stanislas Lefort, don't you?
Yeah, they don't really consciously separate. They just don't stick together because no one thinks to say, "Hold up, wait for us." So Reginald Macintosh find a nunnery that's loading up pumpkins into a van. So they decide to steal the van, complete with a nun inside, Sister Marie, who is pretty feisty, because when she finds out her van's being hijacked, she tries to strangle them until they basically say, "We have Anglais airmen, aviateur," and she goes, "Oh yeah, cool, I'll help you." And so she's well up for it. And then they pick up the friend. It's funny because they've separated for about 5 minutes, they talk about how much they miss each other. Like, we must get the Frenchman. Otherwise, they'll be, "I miss the Frenchman all the whore, whore, whore." And then the Stanislaus going, "Oh, I miss the English all the whore, whore, whore." So they hook it back together again. So the plan is now they will drive to the free zone. However, before they can do that, they run to a checkpoint. So they basically it's the action point, I think. They smash the barricade
now. Yeah, they do.
Yeah, so they smash through the barricade over where there's basically a checkpoint with all these machine gun posts and motorbike stuff. So they smash through the thing, and three motorbike and sidecars are chasing after them. Yeah. So they just pelt them with pumpkins.
But I'm surprised actually that they, because there were lots of pumpkins in that van, not many of them were. Hit the target.
I know, but could you throw a pumpkin from a moving target? It's that
I don't think it's that hard, is it?
But also, the Germans are shooting at them, which is almost it's as real as it gets. But the Germans are firing, the occasional bullet pings off the side of the van.
True.
Hundreds of pumpkins are flying off the back, so they've certainly got the firepower. So in the end, they basically just managed to knock them all out with pumpkins and make their escape to the local nunnery. What's the plan? The plan is now Reginald and Mackie.
Well, they've got to go to Meursault, haven't they?
Yeah, Meursault is where they'll do the border crossing, because this is still there's a Vichy France, there's Free France and
France.
Occupied France. So they can get across into Free France and then make their way out. So the idea is that Stanislaus and Bouveau will scout out the town. Mackintosh and Reginald will lay low, and basically they will hide in barrels that are meant to contain wine.
Yeah.
Marie Odair will trade the wine for a pass across the border, take him across the border, all is well.
Right.
So in the meanwhile, as Stanislaus and Bouvier are scouting out the hotel, there's again another really cool moment where, because Bouvier and Stanislaus are constantly bickering, they're a hilarious odd couple, but there is a moment when Bouvier, who's a little bit more streetwise, they're scooting his bicycle, which Stanislaus tried to exchange once again because his chain has slipped. So he thinks he should have the better bicycle. But as he's going down the bicycle, he hears a German patrol coming, and he just darts into the corridor. And then, Stanislaus
is hurtling behind him, about to run into this marching.
So Bouvier grabs him and hauls him into the shadows. And when they're gone, Stanislaus goes, "Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for saving my life," whatever. So they go into the local hotel. It's like, it's really dark. Why is it so dark? And then the lights fly on, and it's a German birthday party. There's enormous cake.
And again, there's another good scene where the owner of the hotel, she pretends that they've come back drunk again.
Yes, yeah, so the owner's like the head of the resistance, and who can definitely think on her feet. So she just looks at these two random strangers and goes, "Oh, you are my husband. You are out there coming home drunk again." And in fairness to, again, Bouvet is and the actor as well, he does a fantastic. He immediately switches from "I'm confused" to "I'm drunk." Which is a very subtle change, but it's like
it's the way he moves, isn't it? The way he moves. Yeah, it's really clever. It had a touch of it's a touch of Morecambe and Wise about it with them two in this particular one. Yeah, really good.
So they're like, "Oh yeah, we're drunk. We better get out of your way." And the German officer says, "No, it's my birthday. I'm not going to be henpecked. Join our party," which involves this ridiculous chair dance where all the Germans sit backwards on their chairs and form a conga line.
Basically, it's a thing.
It must be things like, because they're banging on the chairs, like, they're dancing around.
Yeah.
It's absolutely hilarious. And of course, these two are caught in the middle of it.
Yeah. It looks absolutely tiring, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. Well, pity the chairs as well. So so they again, once it's all over, they're sent upstairs and they're given a room. They've got to share a double bed. And they said, "We'll wake you at 5 o'clock. You can sneak across the border. I'll give you some guides. It'll be fine." And so
there follows some. About half an hour of extraordinary slapstick.
Oh my, a bedroom farce it would be.
It's farce, isn't it? It's farce as well.
Yeah, because Stanislaus is not happy sharing a bedroom. Bouvier says, "If I snore, just whistle, I'll stop snoring." Yeah. And Stanislaus, again, he's mentioned this before, that, in the intermission, as he calls it, he gets really hungry, and if he doesn't eat, but instead of just saying, "I'm hungry," he gives this wonderful pantomime of, like, stretching his stomach, going, "Roik, roik, roik." And he's like saying, "Oh yeah, I'm rung out. I need to eat." So he goes downstairs breaks into the kitchen and helps himself to a comedically large plate of food.
Yeah, just a bottle of wine,
a bottle of wine,
cheese and bread. And
it's cartoonish the amount of plate he's about to tuck into. At which point, we should say that the German major from Paris, who has been chasing them all this time, has been told, of course, that Cunningham has been captured. He'll come down and interrogate him. So him and his aide have just appeared at the hotel, and they've taken room number 9, which will have to share a double bed. So the German major goes off to the bathroom while the Germans, his lieutenant is sent downstairs to get him something to eat. But again, as he slams his door shut, the nine flips upside down to become a six. So now they both think they're in
the
six.
This is the kind of thing in a film that really stresses me out. You know what's going to happen.
As soon as that number went down, it just happened. Yeah. So Bouville has left his bedroom because Juliet is in the opposite room and he tries to make a pass at her because he's now in love with Juliet. And why wouldn't he be? She's about 20, you know, very blonde and French. And he's like an aging 40-year-old man. And he's like saying, oh, maybe we could, after the war, fall in love. And she's quite sweet, saying, yes, we could, but the war's on. Go back to bed. So he goes back to bed, but he goes back to the wrong room. So he's already in the wrong room. The German major comes in, finds Bouvet in his room, but thinks it's not. So he goes into Bouvet's room, at which point then the German's lieutenant comes downstairs, eventually manages to get the fact that first he tries to get food, and Stanislav has hidden it all in the dumbwaiter and saying, there's no food here. There's the remains of a birthday cake that's got a kind of a sugar icing German.
Gestapo sugar iced.
And he's saying it's very edible. And the German major thinks he can't really eat his commanding officer. But he basically... He realizes Stan has been holding out him and takes his food off him. So he then goes to his correct room, and Stanislav goes to his correct room. But now there's the German major, and there was this big old German major snoring away like a pig.
Described this really well. I would have got totally lost in the description of this.
So now Stanislav is in bed with his mortal enemy, not knowing it, and just thinking he's in bed with his traveling companion who snores a lot. And the amount of actions that Louis de Funès goes through to stop him snoring, he whistles and squeaks and cracks. Makes these cracking noises and he gives all this kind of stuff because he's just so annoyed with his snoring. He's like, rack, 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 rack. And that's what he's like. He's whacking him at one point and you just think, please stop. On the other side, the lieutenant just came in, left a plate of food, gone to bed, and Bouvet just wakes up and goes, great, free food. This is nice. And eat the whole thing. And again, in the morning, again, they're woken up at 5 o'clock and they're woken up too early. They're woken up at the exact time to escape, but too early for the German officers. So, they managed to put together. Stanislav is kind of creeping out, whistling all the while to stop him from snoring. So, whereupon now these two have made out, they've got an outcast across the border. They've given a couple of German shepherd dogs and some comedically ill-fitting German uniforms.
Again, and it's going ridiculous.
Bouvet's one covers his eyes, Stanislav's won't go on top of his head. It is like when Asterix and Obelix borrow the Roman armor. And they're hopeless. They get nowhere trying to cross the mountains. The dogs run away from them. Again, Stanislav somehow convinces Bouvet to give him a piggyback. It's like, first my shoes, then my bike, now I'm carrying you. Because he gets on top of his back. He's like, can you get down now? Don't cause a fuss. Don't cause a fuss. We're getting on the fight. And then they get basically caught by German.
They get
patrol,
caught, don't they? Obviously not German.
So they get marched into the same place where Cunningham is being held, and then at the same time again, Sister Marie is coming up with the barrels of wine. The idea is again she'll trade the wine for a pass, but again the instruction she gives them to this German sergeant. The German sergeant is then revealed is comedically cross-eyed because they don't show it at first. She's chatting away to the back of his head, and it swings around. And you realize,
I have to say, I know that it is not very politically correct, but when he turned around.
I know. It is one of those things like, can you laugh? But it was funny. She's saying, don't take these two barrels on the left. Take these two barrels on the right.
He's obviously, and you see it from his perspective, and the barrels are all like, there's eight of them. He doesn't know which to choose.
They unload the two barrels containing Reginald and Cunningham, Macintosh, which they put in the cellar. So those two then escape.
This has worked out relatively well for Reginald because there's lots of wine in the cellar, isn't there?
He's already helped himself to about. But someone tries to broach the barrel by drilling into it. So he pokes Reginald's bottom, which way they get off, beat up the two Germans, tie them up, and then they obtain the uniforms. Bouvet and Stanislav have also managed to escape through their knowledge of Wagner. It's like, you know Wagner, you can speak German, can't you? It's like, I can't. So they managed to overpower their guards. So basically, they all managed to go in, rescue Cunningham, set the cellar on fire. And very pertinently, the Germans they knocked out and tied up, they then cut their ropes so they weren't burned to death. Because it's very important that nobody in this film dies. Yeah. So they've now caused carnage. They've managed to... set the building on fire. They're then spearing all the tires. They're slashing the tires of all the vehicles in the parking lot.
They've stolen one of the Germans' vehicles, haven't they?
No, no, their sister Marie comes back.
Yeah, of course she does. That's it.
So the only escape is a horse-drawn cart because they were going to.
That's the one. It's a horse-drawn cart. Yeah, that's it.
They were going to steal a truck, but Macintosh is too quick and he slashes the tires of that one too. At which point Terry Thompson goes, "Macintosh, why don't you go back to Canada?" Which is a bit harsh. They're all escaping. They've even stabbed the hoses of the fire brigade who come in, so they're not even putting out the fire very well.
Yeah.
So as they race away, all the Germans try and escape, try and chase after them, but their tires are slashed. So there's a massive pileup. This horse and cart is going cross country hell for leather as they're being buzzed by.
It's quite exciting, isn't it?
It's really going. Like the net at the top is like whipping away,
reminded me a bit of Stagecoach.
I thought Stagecoach too. That's the first thing I thought of.
Yeah.
There's a reconnaissance plane buzzing overhead, yes. And they managed to stop at basically a disused glider shed, where they managed to work out that these gliders, even though they're small, they could cram three to a cabin, so that would fit them all in. And if they basically get the Jeep running empty, it could pull along both gliders over the cliff, at which point they could fly to freedom. As they do this, again, the Germans are arriving. The two gliders manage to take off. They're flying. The wind carries them back. It's carrying them into the path of the German machine gun. And the German major is like talking to the machine gunner saying, "Hey, take aim and fire." And he pulls aside. And who's the man of the machine gun? It's the cross-eyed German gunner. And that bit, I fell apart again. He's going to get shot down. What's going to happen? Nope, it's him. So he actually shoots down the German reconnaissance plane. Once again, the pilot is shown to be parachuting out because everyone's nice and safe.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's it. And then the two gliders are seen flying to freedom. Again, but both the two British airmen in the cockpit with Sister Marie, they start to kiss her, which she takes.
She starts praying, doesn't she? Yeah. Well, she's not. She's praying for thanks. That's what she's doing, isn't she?
But again, Bouvet and Stanislav and Reginald and the other one all cheering and happy they've made it, and they fly to freedom, and that's the movie.
There we go. Yeah, very good. Nicely done. That was quite a complicated movie as well to describe.
Oh yeah,
I think
it's quite a complicated movie to watch.
Well, it's got. We'll go into the themes of it, but farce and slapstick. Always really hard to describe, I think, because you really got to watch it to get the real feel for it. But very good.
But indeed, so we'll take a little break there for an aperitif and possibly an enormous bowl of food, and do join us after the break when we shall discuss. Again, we'll go back to why we picked the film, which we haven't done for a whole year.
Oh God!
Why we picked it, and again, what we thought of it.
Very good.
Bienvenue ici, that's probably not welcome back, but welcome back. Welcome back to Weekend at Cromwell's, where we're looking at Le Grand Vadrouille.
Hugh, can you remember why you chose this film?
Can I remember which is film? I did have to refresh my memory. I think the basic premise is that I heard it mentioned on a podcast about like the 10 greatest French films. And,
oh, wow.
And I wasn't that interested in the other 9. And this one thought, I've got to watch this. This is, this sounds brilliant.
Have you ever heard of this?
Never heard of it. Again, this is why I suppose I'll come into that. So my basic motivation was I'd heard about it and it sounded good. That's as much as it was. But it breaks a lot of the rules of Weekend at Cromwell's because we were supposed to pick films that were not popular or not successful. This is phenomenally popular in France. It's I think one of the greatest or possibly the most popular French comedies or French films ever made of all time.
Between 1966, Hugh, when this was made, and 1997, it was the biggest grossing film in French history. Exactly. And that's not French films, that's all films. Yeah. And it was toppled by Titanic.
Titanic.
And even now, it is still the fifth biggest grossing film in France.
Yeah, and I think
heard of it.
No, never heard of it. This, I think, is like the British staples that you watch every year. Like the most The Great Escape or something like that. Everyone knows, but it just comes around and around. Again, it's really popular in Germany as well. It was like higher than the charts of Germany. It got dethroned by another film recently. It's got a couple of apparently. Again, I don't know the immense French comedic stars acting in it.
Bourville and Louis de Funès, absolutely. Yeah. They are titans of French cinema and theatre.
So again, once again, you don't even need to know that by this film. If someone tells you there's a fantastic French comedic star in it, you can tell who they are when you watch it. They are fantastic. But
I quite like the idea that the fifth biggest grossing film of all time at the French box office stars Terry Thomas. It's just, which makes me wonder why it's not more well known in the UK, because this is a France, Great Britain co-produced film.
Is it?
Yes, it was made by Le Film Corona and Rank and the Rank organization.
Oh my goodness.
So it's, yeah, you know, it's a co-production, yeah, and it's got, you know, Terry Thomas, who was a pretty big star in the 60s, oh, yeah, right?
Yeah, I would say from my perspective then, it fills the criteria of Weekend at Crombie's in the sense it was an unsuccessful film in the English language. It hasn't got that cut through. But my goodness, in its own on its own turf, it's immense as a titan. And yeah, so that was why I picked it.
Very good, very good. The other thing that's interesting about this is that the year before, Gérard Houry, who's the director, André Bourvil, who played Bouvet, and Louis de Funès, who played Stanislas Fort, were in a film together called The Sucker, which was, until Le Grand Vaudeville was released the year later, the biggest grossing film in the French box office ever. So they had success. And they replicated it here, effectively. That was the idea.
I wonder, just again, a small point on the casting then. Maybe this would have felt a bit more Anglo French if the other two airmen had been played by Englishmen, because of course they got Terry Thomas,
not, though, are they?
Who is quintessentially English. I mean, his Englishness oozes over everything, so that covers it.
Yeah.
But again, I think is it Cunningham is Claudio Brook, who's Mexican.
He's Mexican,
and,
yeah.
McIntosh is French American, and neither one of them look remotely English, even
they
before they're
sound open
their
English. And to be honest, they're not fantastic actors either. Well, but I think this is one of those instances where some of the supporting cast in films like this, where there is a co-production, some of the supporting cast, they don't quite feel natural in their roles, right? Because they're either not speaking the right language or they're trying to behave in a particular way. But yeah, I agree. If it was, I don't know, maybe if Peter Sellers was in this as well, you know, something, then perhaps it would have had that more grand view in the UK. But I think, you know, it's a shame, really, because I'm surprised this didn't go down well in the UK or wasn't seen by many, because it's just bloody funny.
I know. Well, yes, let's start on the themes of its comedic chops, because again, this runs for, what is it, 2 hours?
It's just over 2 hours, isn't it?
Over two hours. And and normally a good comedy is lean. They're like 90 minutes, 100 minutes. I mean, this doesn't really feel like a 2 hour movie. It just romps along. A lot happens in it. We go from, because I thought initially, is it just going to be hijinks running around Paris and everything? But no, they leave Paris to go to a different location.
Absolutely.
And so they go from location to location to location. And it's quite epic in terms of its scale in that regard.
But
the energy of it is never lost. You're so carried along, because it's all consistently funny. It never lags in terms of, sometimes with comedies, you'll get the initial premise, a couple of laughs, maybe you'll get one at the ending, and in the middle's quite flabby. This is just goes on and on and on. Everything, even is something as simple as they go to a hotel to spend the night, is jammed with laughter. Who thought they'd come to a German birthday party and end up with an entirely random bedroom fight? Yeah, it's like, it's really, really just full of laughs. And again, looking at, I suppose, the top three comedic performances, Terry Thomas obviously does the English airman, you know, he's been playing that role all his life. Louis de Funès, again, both he and Bourvil were good, but I thought, I really loved Louis's energy. He's like, just the beginning when he was just doing the conductor stuff, you thought, I bet fans of him are just waiting for this, because he's just, he's just revving up.
Because they know who he is, don't they? Yeah. They know who he is. And he was renowned for this over-the-top, bombastic comedic style.
Yeah, yeah. And well, again, this is the thing, because his energy is fantastic, the whole film. Like I say, he's a little ball of frustrated, angry, you know, sort of energy. This kind of upper-class stuff. But you say, again, over-the-top. It is in one way over-the-top. But what I really liked about this film is it never got into complete... Like, it is a farce in the bed.
It's not caricature,
concept,
though, is it?
They're never stupid. They are making rational... Yeah. It's hilarious what happens. And even though you say, you know, fishing for in the prostitute area for people to steal their clothes is a bit
extreme. There's a logic to it, though, isn't
there? Everything they do is logical, and no one is being absolutely ridiculous. And, like, even when he ends up in bed with a German major, he doesn't cuddle up to him and have some kind of... It's like...
You're right. It's not a carry-on, is it?
Exactly.
That's the thing. Yeah. It's not a carry-on. Yeah, I agree with you completely. I tend to be erring on the side of Louis de Funès as the one that I kind of like more. But I think the issue is that the good thing is that they have chemistry together, don't they?
Yes.
And the fact that they're very different in the way that they've approached their characters. So Bourvil is very I don't know, he's quieter, he's more sanguine, I suppose, really. He's less prone to these explosive outbursts. But he's probably quicker on his feet a little bit. He's a bit shambolic as well. So I like the chemistry together. And actually, what I really liked about this is that you've said it's funny from start to end. It's a farce. It's got slapstick elements to it. But in a comedy that's over 2 hours long, I don't think you can just rely on the comedy to take you through, right? Otherwise, it's just watching, you know, it can be a bit tiring. But I think what this film has, as well as the comedy, is a really good story. It's got really good story. And there's lots of really good set pieces. And I don't mean comedic set pieces. I mean almost action set pieces. There's really good.
Yeah.
The film is not just a comedy. I mean, it is a comedy, but I think it's a bit more than this. It does the get from plot point A to plot point B and then to plot point C via plot point C1 or 2 really well.
Yeah.
And so the momentum keeps you going, because my feeling on it would be, if about half an hour in you were saying there's going to be about a 20-minute scene in about an hour's time where they end up in a hotel and there's that, you know, it's farcical because they're sleeping with the German commanders or commandants, I'd probably go, wow, you know, that's and that's in an hour and it's about 20 minutes long. Crikey. But by the time it happened, you know, I was like, oh, I'm up for this. This is brilliant. It's really good. And I think it helps that all the settings were slightly different. So I really like the vibe of the film where they're actually, it felt like a road trip, right?
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
out and that really helped. I also like the fact that there is a lot of humor in this, but it's never really, and what you might expect in a film a little bit like this, and I think if this was more British, it would have done this, the humor would have been more mean, I think, in the sense that you would have had the French couple almost a little bit more taking the mickey out of the British side and the other way around. But it doesn't do that. There's no caricature here. They really are just on the same sides, you know. If anything, the butt of everyone's jokes here are the Nazis, which I think is fair enough.
Right? Yeah, it is interesting that, there's never a sense of, like I say, they're helping out people in a jam. There's not an ideological sense in terms of we must do this to win the war. It's like, you need help. You know, we'll help
good
you
eggs,
out.
Aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, say they're not characterised. I mean, Terry Thomas is very British Airman, but he's not.
Oh, again, sure, he is. Yeah. But Bourville and Le Founs are being very French, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it doesn't spill into caricature in the way that it could have.
Yeah, no, it is really good like that. It feels very well. And you're right about the story. The story is a ripping one and quite cleverly plotted. Because again, at the point when Cunningham and Juliet get separated on the train, I thought, are they out of the story now? We're surely not going to have two concurrent threads. Mm. But then they split and they split and they split again. You get several threads that all come together, obviously for the finale. But there's a lot of moving pieces to get everyone back into the same place, which is really cool. It's a nice going on. And you're right about the set pieces. That stagecoach thing. There's a stuntman in a nun's costume whipping those horses on. Well, like I said, the horse is tearing along, the wheel explodes, they're all thrown out of it, and they got to run to the next thing. It's like there's a real sense of urgency.
And the glider sequence is really exciting as well, because they're going at a pace. I mean, I'm not quite sure. If it was me, I'd be thinking, how do you know that the rope on the car is going to
disengage.
Because I'd be thinking, are you sure it's going to do this? But anyway, it doesn't matter. But it was still a thrilling exercise.
Yeah, there was a lot in there. And again, there was never in a sense of when they run along that the camera speeds up and the music gets funny. They can run as fast as they can run. And there's actual peril, except of course when the German machine gun is crook out.
That's the hilarious
part about it. It's both ridiculous but like plausible.
Well, it's ridiculous, but I mean, I suppose that's probably the closest to the edge that it gets.
It's like Deus Ex Machina. It's like the German
kind of, that's the closest it gets to really kind of bordering on caricature or ridiculous. But I mean,
it's so funny. Well, that's the thing.
It is really funny, and the point is at the point in which that happens, you're completely invested in the film, and the characters anyway.
Yeah.
So it's not really an issue, and it's funny. If that gag had been much earlier in the film, I might have disengaged with it a little bit because I'm thinking, is it going to be this kind of film? Oh God, I hope not. But actually, because it happens in the last 20 minutes of the film, in the end, it's almost, well, it's just silly, isn't it? It's just silly. It's supposed to be silly. It's not supposed to be taken too seriously. So I just found it hilarious, really. And it worked a treat, to be honest, in that context as well.
Because it gives you a really big laugh. 2 minutes in the end. No, a lot of comedies will just save their laughs.
It's funny right to the end.
Right to the end, you're still laughing. I was in pieces.
Well, it's funny right to the end. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's really good. The other thing I think this film could have been, and I was grateful that it wasn't, was a film about people being in the wrong place at the wrong time. So sometimes you get films about people being out of place. Yeah. So what I was thinking, it might be like a comedy of manners almost, when, you know, Terry Thomas and the British Airmen drop down in Paris, and it's about them trying to figure out how to get through Paris customs and culture and this kind of stuff as well. And it isn't really that, which is good. In the end, it's a war film, isn't it? It's a war film. It's a comedy war film about trying to get these people to safety. And it sticks to that. And because of that, I think it's really tight, and you can just let the humor flow over you, which works fantastically.
I mean
I have not laughed so much at a film while watching this for a long time. Right, and maybe that says something about my sense of humor at the moment. As I get older, my sense of humor becomes more simple, but this was clever stuff. And I always find farce particularly is really, if it's done well, it looks so simple. Yeah. But if it's done badly, it's awful. So I think it's so much harder than it looks. I think this is a real triumph.
Yeah, there's things that, like I've described, the Turkish bath scene is hilarious, but you've forgotten that after 2 hours in, because that's just one... That for a lot of things, that would be the funniest part of the movie. It's like, remember the Turkish bath scene?
It's the little things in it where the man with the big moustache, he's slightly overweight. He looks ridiculous because he looks like he's got a wig on. He's got this big moustache, and they're kind of hitting on him, aren't they?
Because T for Two is quite a playful little flirty song. If you go up to someone who's half naked and go, T for Two, for me...
The way they're looking at him, and then they start looking at each other. It's just the realization that something's quite right here, but they're not quite sure. And Borville, I think, plays that really well, because he's almost, okay. I don't know what to do now.
The steam gets so thick they can duck under it. It's almost like a blanket. But that's just one thing. Everything is so well realized. And again, there's things. Again, Juliet and her grandfather are puppeteer, and they start sending signals to the because Augustine and Reginald at one point come along, and they can't make contact because, like, there's Germans around or that. And she has Mr. Punch say, "Augustine will save me. Everybody shout Augustine." It's like all the kids shouting, "Augustine, Augustine." But at this point, a really curious 6-year-old girl is staring at Augustine. He's messing a German officer, and he goes like, "She's staring at me, Reginald." It's like, just play it cool. She's staring at me.
That's nothing detail.
It's a bridging moment. Exactly. But everything is like, let's get a gag in here.
Yeah, there's no shoe leather, is there? It's not wasted at all. And I think that. You've got to respect that on a filmmaking level and a craftspersonship level, you know, whether, you know, the writing, the acting, the bringing it together. You've got to respect that to the extent that even if what happens as a consequence falls a bit flat, you've still got to respect that commitment to the story, I guess. But the fact that really hardly anything falls flat in this film, I can't think of a single joke that doesn't hit or a single sequence that didn't leave me I'm not rolling around on the floor necessarily, but just honestly, just almost I mean, at the start of the film, I wasn't crying with laughter. I was chuckling to myself. I know there's this kind of it's like an avalanche of jokes that happen. So by the end, I really was crying with tears because it was almost ridiculous.
But it almost takes its time in the setting of the moving parts, because you have three different locations, and then, like, in the opera, you've got both the opera, and then you've got the Germans come in, and you've got the resistance setting a bomb, and there's a lot of things that just say, remember all these details, they'll come into it, and, like, you know, 15 minutes later, the floral bomb they take their time, and they kind of keep you going by just having, like, the performance of Louis de Funès, you know, yelling at his orchestra. It's like, this will keep you going, this is funny, and then it gets done, but this is now really kicks off. So it paces itself nicely. It doesn't, like, go for the, you know, the immediate farcical stuff. It's like, this is just, you know, they're parachuted out, they've landed, yeah. they've got to get with going, and all of a sudden one of them is dressed as a chorus girl, and now they've got to yeah. send him up as a honey trap.
Honestly, I love films like this. Films like this aren't made anymore. They're just, they really should be. But in a film like this, you know, I also think that the characters, Bouvet and Lefort, they have no right to have a character arc, right? Yeah, yeah. But they do. They both learn about each other. They both respect each other at the end. You know, in the end, Bouvet saves Lefort's life twice, right? Yeah. And there's a grudging respect, and then there's almost like a full blown friendship, yeah. you know. And it's breaking down those social barriers in there as well. It's fantastic.
And the bit when they're in German uniforms for their capture after Bouvet's just had a piggyback, Stanislav just had a piggyback on him. Bouvet just breaks down and goes, "Look, I'm tired. I can't do this anymore." And it's up to Lefort to pull him back together.
Yeah, exactly.
It is really nice.
It's really good. It's really good. And you know, even the supporting characters that come in quite late. So the sister is really good in it. You know, she has a minor role in it, but she plays a really she has agency. Yeah. So she isn't just a female character in it. She's absolutely necessary to fulfill the requirements. Major Achbach is hilarious. Yeah. I mean, he's also slightly terrifying as well, which is, he should be, but he's also quite a, you know, he's a figure of fun, I guess, to a certain extent, particularly in the hotel. The hotel manager works really well, you know. Yeah. There's loads in it, I just think.
I was gonna say, in the supporting cast, it's interesting that all the women in the cast basically have got their stuff together. It's like they've
all got their stuff together, haven't they? Yeah, they're dealing with stuff, aren't they?
Like, yeah, Juliet isn't a member of Resistance, she's the, you know, someone who's sympathetic, but as soon as she has to be, you know, she's able to cover for Cunningham. She's able to link up with the hotel manager and actually know what to do. Yeah. The hotel manager's running the resistance. I did think at some point, though, it was almost like the Juliet role and the Sister Marie role just got handed over like a baton. It's like,
we
want to have another young woman in this. Juliet can't really fit into this. We need to have Sister Marie in there.
Yeah.
And then it could easily have been Juliet driving the cart, because that would have been more natural. But they, you know, it makes more sense, which I suppose actually is good for them, for not forcing it to have. They need a cart driving nun who delivers wine. And Juliet can't fulfill that role anymore.
She can't fulfill that role. No, you're right. And it also means that they are able to stay at the is it a nunnery?
It's got a nunnery hospital. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Because there's even a nice scene with the sister at the hospital as well.
The matron. That was a really cool scene. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. When Terry Thomas's character is he's in. Well, he's pretending to be sick, obviously, but he isn't. And she's saying, you know, it's your liver. Is your liver poor?
She thinks he does liver is poor because she jabs him in the liver.
Yeah, exactly. And then she realizes that they are a British airman, and she's basically like, oh, okay, fine, this is great. So she's helpful as well, right?
I think it was set up, because she's she says she's listened to his chest and says, say 33 for me. And it's up to Sister Marie to nod to Terry Thomas, saying, yes, she can be trusted. So he says 33 in English. So there's a nice undercurrent of, the French, I suppose in this point, the French have, you know, they've been defeated, but they're not under.
That's what the resistance is, isn't it?
And exactly.
It shows you a little bit, I guess, in terms of the type of techniques and requirements that the resistance had to go through. You know, it was that clandestine. I mean, if there's one criticism I have of the film, perhaps, and this is me really nitpicking, I guess I was surprised to find every single French person in this film incredibly helpful. Yeah. I'm not saying that French people generally, from my experiences, aren't helpful. They are. It's all good. But where were the Vichy members of the French population in Paris?
They were living in Vichy.
Well, I suppose they were, but it's almost a little bit too easy to a certain extent. But really,
yeah. Well, that's why I wondered about kind of the zeitgeist of the film, because again, it was massively popular, because it's massively popular because it's a really good film. It's very funny and it's brilliant. But also, did it speak to something in the French psyche about, you know, this was our bit of the war. We were, you know, we may have been conquered, but we weren't defeated. So it's, you know, we were sticking two fingers up. Again, it's mentioned Asterix and Obelix. I imagine that came around, the idea of
an
occupied people who still able to get one over on the oppressive. So even though, funnily enough, it's the the most famous British war films are generally about either disasters or capture. We really do the massive successes. It's all about overcoming.
It's true, isn't it?
Overcoming immense odds.
Well, I suppose in the end, history tells us that that is what happened. Well, actually, I mean, overcoming great odds, but also. Oh, I don't want to go into a Second World War view of how things happen, but you know what I mean? It's like, well, if a British Second World War film is going to focus on the fact that we probably shouldn't have survived the Second World War, but somehow did, right? Yeah. Whereas in France, it didn't happen. Yeah. And so there has to be other stories about that. I actually tend to find that French films set during the war are a little bit more interesting. Because often they are about resistance fighters and they are about the clandestine ways and routes that they had to get information in and out of Paris and France, and they had to use that information to help or hinder people during that time as well, you know. So I find they're quite interesting moral films rather than just bombastic, you know, tub-thumping patriotic films, whereas actually this is a bit more of the latter. Whereas a film like I'm trying to think of the film which has got what's it called? Oh, Army of Shadows, which is cracking French war drama about the resistance. You know, it's a dark film. It's a hard film to watch. Certainly isn't a comedy, but it's a very philosophical film. It's a very moral film. It asks questions about the French psyche as well, which is really interesting. This does none of that, but it doesn't need to necessarily, right? It's just a romp that set the Second World War. And actually, maybe this is what the French public wanted and needed at this particular time, that reassessment, that view back, which said, you know what, it was a bad time, but we can laugh about it now. We've overcome it. That's quite good. And actually, maybe that's unfair. They're not laughing at it at all in this. No. At all. This is why I think it works so well. There's nothing in here which is mean. It's all really sweet, positive, plot-driven, farce-heavy, hilarious, character focused comedy. And I don't think, you know, if you said that phrase to me, I'd be like, even if I've never heard the film, I want to watch this film. And that's this.
It is interesting. Again, you mentioned kind of the psyche of the wars, in that the way that it was the British like to see the Second World War is, how did we scrape through it? We got by somehow. Rather than the opposite view of, a massive imperial power ruthlessly collapsed. exploiting every advantage to power down another imperial power.
We somehow
got through with, dad's army and a bit of luck. It's like, no, we had a massive navy.
We had a massive
Wealth of an empire.
We had the wealth of an empire, a massive navy, and I think it helped that Hitler went completely bonkers.
Yeah.
Completely the wrong time for the Nazis, right? But the way
the way we like to see it is, a couple of plucky guys with some wire cutters broke through and did the business.
I don't think the French have that.
No.
They don't have that in their war history. In their Second World War history, I suppose.
But I suppose in terms of contemporaries, I mean, this is sort of like 20 years before A Low Low, but it felt like A Low Low the movie, but a lot better. better. But that same kind
of
vibe.
There was a little bit of that, wasn't there? Yeah, I suppose.
But also I was also a bit of the fact that this is mid-60s. This was the kind of, when the French did a comedic film, it was this, and when we do it, it was, God bless them, the Carry On movies.
It's true, isn't it?
I know we would have put out other comedic films, but there's no comparison. This is just so far ahead of
high quality, right?
This is really, really good.
You can't come in. I've got a lot of time for some Carry On films. Absolutely. Not many, but some Carry On films. But I mean, this is better than all of them.
I've got a lot of time for a lot of pantomimes, but I'm not thinking for Olivier Awards. It's like you can enjoy something and still know its quality.
Yeah. You're right. It's very true. Thinking about other films that this might
I was going to say in other films. Any other comments before we go to other films? Sure.
No, I mean, I don't know. I think that's just a really look. I finished the film really happy with a smile on my face, thinking, come on, that was cracking. I want to be in the company of these characters. And I want to live in France.
I kind of started it with like 2 hours, okay, let's get into this. But
I was a little bit like that.
It's 2 hours is fantastic.
Yes, it is. It actually, you're that's that's a good point as well, because the first few minutes, I thought, or the first 5 or 10 minutes, I thought, this is going to be one of those weird Euro co-productions that just doesn't quite fit. But it didn't. It really didn't take long to get me over that. And I can't say I was massively enthusiastic of 130 odd minutes of, French and British caricatures. But I'm very grateful that it didn't become that at all. So that was fantastic.
Yeah. Having done that, we'll come to the part where we say films that were similar to. I haven't got much of this. So I forgot we normally do it. It's been a year.
That's all good. Yeah, I know.
I would only say again from this, I basically want to see a lot more Louis de Funès films.
Yeah,
Again, as good as Bouvet was, I thought Stanislav Defoe, Louis de Funès.
He was fantastic in this, yeah.
Absolute find. Again, he's one of the greatest French stars of all time, I now learn. But, oh, God, he was funny. He was just, he was so energetic, so funny. I think he, died of a heart attack, and that doesn't surprise me because...
Well, he died of a heart attack after the third heart attack he had, and it was attributed to his over-energetic stage persona.
Yeah, I can easily imagine it. So I think, I'd find Le Gendarme de Saint-Tropez, La Foire de Grandier, things like that. I think track down Louis de Funès films, and I imagine you would be disappointed. I'm going to find a few more. That is so funny.
Well, I get the impression that in a double act, you'd be Stanislas Defoe, and I'd be much more of Beauvais, wouldn't I?
Beauvais had the Bernard Breslau to him, yeah. So you'd be the stolid workmanlike blue collar. I'd be the small choleric one.
Well, actually, if you want to see, I don't know, I've not seen any other Stanislav Lefort films, but I've seen another André Bourvil film, which is called Le Cercle Rouge, the Red Circle, I presume.
Indeed.
It was his penultimate film, actually. It was made in 1970 or 1971, I can't remember which. And it's a heist film, effectively. Ooh. And he plays, it's not a comedy at all, it's a thriller, a proper, deep, dark thriller as well. And he plays the detective, the inspector, who is tasked with finding this, really, really efficient heist team. It's excellent, excellent film. It's brilliantly made. And it's, it's influenced a lot of films like Ocean's 11 and stuff like that as well. So I would very much recommend Le Cercle Rouge.
Le Cercle Rouge, okay, excellent.
Very much. Wow. The other film, weirdly, that this reminded me of a little bit, was Inglourious Bastards. And for no other reason that there is an element of a ragtag group of people getting together to achieve a goal, and it goes, there's a bit of going through the countryside in it. I don't know, there's a bit of a vibe about it that made me, it reminded me of that.
I suppose there's an opera scene when everybody speaks.
Yeah, there is, yeah, as well. Yeah, exactly, too. So there's something there. Oh, it did make me think, I wonder if Tarantino's seen this. Knowing Tarantino, he probably has seen this, hasn't he? He's seen everything, hasn't he? Whether he'd admit to it being an influence or not, I don't know.
I probably would if it was French cinema.
Yeah, but the thing is, this isn't the kind of... maybe why?
Oh, I see.
Well, I don't know. This isn't the kind of French cinema that is normally picked up, though, is it? So,
I've
never heard of this film before in my life. Never heard of it. But I've seen a lot of the French New Wave of, guess what? The 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, right?
Okay.
So, and I've seen a lot of French films from those eras. So, Godard films, Resnais films, loads, Claude Chabrol, all of these, major directors with, incredible visions and things to say about French society and the human condition and all that kind of stuff as well. And some are good and some are utterly pretentious. Some are great and some are bad, right? But they're all of this kind of deep thinking French. And this is the French film from the 60s, particularly, that translates internationally. They're awards winners. Right, they create the image of this auteur. The auteur is French for a reason, right? That's the terminology comes from directors like Godard, and yet Le Grand Vaudreuil is a completely different film, right? So it's on a different kind of spectrum of genre, but there's elements of that in this, elements of that quality in this. So I don't see why this wouldn't have been put in that brand. For me, it's a little bit like Stanislas Lefort is the French New Wave, and Beauvais is the slapstick French, the real France almost, right? And, internationally, no one's interested in Beauvais. They're interested in the bombastic, it's the class thing again, I suppose.
Yeah.
This should be as well known as any of those in the UK, and I don't know why it isn't. Maybe I should go and watch The Sucker, which was the film that these three, the director and the two main French actors, did together before this.
Yeah.
Because this was that was the film that was hugely successful, that almost made them a partnership. And then they decided to make this film. So I'm quite keen to go and watch that.
La Cognarde.
Yeah, La Cognarde. Yeah, exactly.
That's not a bad idea, actually. Yeah.
So I might do, if it's available anywhere, I might see if I can find it, because it can't, I mean, it's not going to be bad, is it? Right?
No, that's a good point, isn't it? I might seek that out, actually. But,
yeah, La Cognarde, yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, there we are then. That's our view. We're not doing La Cognarde next month, but look at that segue. Join us after the break when we shall learn what we will be doing next month. And also, of course, we've got to give our scores for Le Convidou. Welcome back. We've taken a brisk stroll after the great stroll through the French countryside, and we're now ready to squeeze in on either side of a nun into our glider and take off towards Vichy, France.
Good. Very good, Hugh. Blimey, such quality this is.
Before we do that, of course, we've got to give our scores. So
of course we do.
I think you go first. I go first.
You go first.
Yeah, I'll go first. Yeah. I mean, we've just raved about this film. I can't not give it a 5. It's just fantastic. And again, I sometimes find foreign language films harder to access, but it's just, I think that you could watch this and not understand a word. There's no subtitles, and the energy given out by it is so strong, and the characters are so well defined. You don't need to understand every word to know exactly what's going on and to feel what's going on and to laugh your head off at what's happening. But yeah, it's tightly plotted. The characters are very strongly portrayed. There's some great actors in this. It's a good story. It's very, very funny. It's a really pleasant 2 hours. 5 floating Crombie hits for me.
What a way to start the year.
I know, that was worth a year waiting for.
It really was. Given that I didn't have any high hopes for this and really didn't want to watch it because I'd never heard of it. And then when I saw that the British title was called Don't Look Now, We're Being Shot At, I thought, God, this is going to be awful, isn't it? but there we go. So... I think the best thing that I can say about this film is that it had me in absolute stitches pretty much all the way through. But there's just a crescendo of joy when I was watching this film. It is ostensibly a high farce, a comedy with ridiculous set pieces in it. But more importantly, it's a film which really develops the characters of those involved. You want to be in and around their company. It has a plot which is propulsive, that is exciting, and that has some emotional connection to it. You want these characters to succeed, and there is a danger if they don't. It takes it all with a lightness of touch that really belies the British title, shall we say. So for me, it's 5 disembodied Crombie heads, and it's as strong a 5 as I can remember giving.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah. Absolute loved it. Belter. I loved every second of it.
Oh, well, what a pick by me.
You're well happy now, aren't you?
I am. Oh, but my goodness. Again, for the whole year, I've been sweating. You know, what is Le Grand Boudreau that I've made us watch and tease up so long? But yeah, that was a treat. Absolute treat. And if, again, it doesn't quite meet the criteria of unsuccessful films, but I'm so glad to have unearthed this.
I don't know, you know, Hugh. I think it's... Look, I know that we've said that Weekend at Crombie's is about shining a light on unsuccessful films, but it doesn't have to necessarily be just about that.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's about a film that perhaps sits within a canon of other films that hasn't quite hit the mark for whatever reason in different markets, or by a director who has a lot of big films and there's one that really just doesn't shine out. This film is hugely successful in France, but is nothing in the UK.
Yeah.
So why? Right. I don't believe that it can be anything about the British sensibility here. Just maybe they weren't exposed to it at the time. I don't know what it was. I think it does fit into the Weekend at Crombie's canon very well.
Very good. Well, with any luck, our 12 listeners will turn that trend around and we can get it watched in the UK, because I'd recommend it. It's available on a free trial for the streaming service. So go for it. Get watch the Grand Boudreau. If nothing else, it's worth the 7-day trial just to watch that.
Well, it's free, isn't it?
Indeed.
I mean, to be honest, it would be worth... I was going to say it'd be worth watching last year in Marion Bad, but I wouldn't. I wouldn't do that. Anyway.
But anyway, what are we watching?
It's exciting. My first choice. Oh, no, this is stressful as well. So for the episode 2, we will be watching Hobson's Choice.
Ooh, Hobson's Choice, Say No More. And until then, join us in February. We should be doing Hobson's Choice. But until then, we once again wish you a very happy and a very healthy weekend, Shay Crombie.
Good evening, all.
Weekend at Crombie's.
The best thing I found was when I tried to watch Le Grand Vaudou.
yeah.
I thought, well, you know, Alexa's got voice recognition. I'll just say what I want. So I don't want to type out Vadrouille.
No.
So I was like, Alexa, Le Grand Vaudou. Nope. La Grande Vadrouille. Nope. La Grande Vaudou. So, okay, I'll just say the English translation, yeah, which is help, I'm being shot at. So,
which
Alexa,
is such a bad name.
Yeah, help, I'm being shot at. And then it was like, if you are in danger, please call the emergency services. It's like, do you really think if I'm actually being shot at, my first recourse is to turn on the smart TV and plead for help?